All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Friday, May 18th, 2018. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Friday, everyone. It is a somewhat chilly 52 degrees, but sunny, and the trees have leaves here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off on Wednesday? We titled the show Guest Carl Grossman, discussing Plum Island. We had Carl Grossman on the show, and Carl outlined some of the 50 years of research that he'd been doing into environmental disasters, one of which happens to be Plum Island, and he detailed his three visits to the island himself. And it was quite a treat for me because I don't get to talk to people too often who actually have knowledge about some of the stuff that I've researched. It was very horrifying, you have to admit, and it was very eye-opening that some of the mad science gone mad that we talk about on this show is not too far-fetched. We discussed a book titled Lab 257, which I had run across a few weeks ago and found a PDF and started reading, and came across Carl's name a couple different times in talking about the history of Plum and some of the incidents that happened where they took media with them, Carl being one of them. And I couldn't believe it was the same Carl Grossman that UCY knows as a guest on a few of the anti-nuclear shows on this network. So it was pretty awesome. But one of the things that Carl talked about was some of the experimentation that was going on in entomological warfare, and some of that was from Eric Traub, I believe, who was a former Nazi scientist. We're going to take a little bit further look at that here coming up. But he had been experimenting with insects spreading disease as disease vectors in the past, and then we brought him over here, and he continued on with that research. And I would imagine, because it was a federal facility, it was on our dime as well. Well, one of the diseases that are being spread by ticks is Lyme disease, and we're going to take a look at Lyme also. But let's take a look at what is going on with ticks. There is a CDC distribution document titled Geographic Distribution of Ticks That Bite Humans on their website, and I will link to this in the notes. But it's actually very frightening when you take a look at the maps. There's a bunch of different maps. One is for the American dog tick, and that's the one that Carl mentioned that we had back in the 50s. Then we also have the black-legged tick, the brown dog tick, the Gulf Coast tick, the Lone Star tick, the Rocky Mountain wood tick, and the western black-legged tick. The one thing that's really, really enlightening looking at all of these different maps is that you realize that most of us in this country are in regions that have a significant tick population. And now that there are infected ticks, and if you read stories from the very beginning about when Lyme first emerged, and that was back in the 70s, I don't actually have that story up, but I should have. In Lyme, Connecticut, which is just across the waterway from where? Oh, Plum Islands. Yeah, go figure. And they discovered that there are like 350 species of migratory birds that actually land on Plum on their way to their final destination. So if you have an overabundance of ticks that are really hungry, sitting on an island that is isolated from the mainland, what do you think they're going to jump on? Anything that lands there. So we got a problem, Clyde. So right, here's a story out of National Geographic. This is 2014. I don't really remember any of this much in the mainstream. What is Lyme disease? New findings deepen the mystery. And a brand new study in 2014 points to sexual transmission, and that has added to the controversy. Now, interesting, because even something like Zika virus, they found out in the very end, was also sexually transmitted. You're going to find out a lot of these viruses you can even catch just from skin-to-skin contact. Not all of them, but some of them. It's pretty disturbing to me. Rampant disagreement over what constitutes Lyme disease, in particular, who may have contracted it and how long it lasts, has spawned the larger question of how to best treat it. There's an epidemic right now. A new study points to the possibility of sexual transmission of the pathogen, and it adds fuel to the fire. Amid the uncertainty, the patient-led lobby that includes doctors as well as Lyme sufferers, both for treatment and insurance purposes, but the medical establishment asserts that the too liberal a definition and what is seen as renegade practitioners has led to irresponsible and potentially dangerous treatment of unrelated maladies misidentified as Lyme. It is also unknown how many people have died because of Lyme. In 2011, a study found that 114 deaths reported over a five-year period listed Lyme as a partial or direct cause. Only one was consistent with clinical manifestations as described in the International Classification of Disease. In December 2013, the CDC confirmed Lyme carditis, which is a condition where the Lyme bacterium infects the heart. It's caused three deaths over the past 2 years, and between 1985 and 2008, only four other fatal cases were confirmed. Now, this is kind of boring. This isn't what I was expecting. I might have pulled up the wrong story. Hold on 1 second. What does Lyme look like? Because this was the interesting part. And now everything is going to look like. So what's interesting about Lyme is that it was a corkscrew type bacteria, and it flagellated itself to be able to zip around the body and get into different organ systems. We have seen something like that before when we looked at Bacillus bacteria, and anthrax is part of the Bacillus family. Now, I tried to find some correlation between Bacillus bacteria and Lyme bacteria, which is called Bacilliosis or something like that. Oh, God. I am so disorganized now, guys. You don't even know. Forget it. Something like that. Brucellosis. B. brucellosis, maybe. And it's a spirochete, something like that, which means it's a little corkscrew bacteria. But where have you seen a flagellal corkscrew bacteria before? Was in the creation of little nanobots. I was like, wait, where did I see that before? It was when my co-writer and I had done a story and we looked at like five coming technologies, those nanobots in your blood. One was using this little corkscrew type bacteria. Well, wait till you hear this. This really caught my attention. And this was published June 24, 2015. So first I've seen of this as well. Corkscrew nanobots drill through blocked arteries. Oh, let's hope that they don't recommend this one to me. These micro swimmers, which are inspired by Lyme disease viruses, ding, ding, are biodegradable and won't trigger an immune response within the body. Traditional methods of treating blocked arteries involve working around blockages with stents and expanding the arteries using little inflatable balloons, and an ambitious multinational research project is working on a third approach, and that would be drilling through blocked arteries with corkscrew-shaped nanobots. Researchers at the Drexler University, and that's not Eric Drexler, announced today, but it was funny, the correlation, that they'll be joining a partnership of 11 institutions worldwide in developing the procedure, which they hope will be deployed in clinical settings within the next 4 years. It works like this. A string of nanoscale iron oxide beads are delivered into the patient's bloodstream via a catheter. These beads, so probably like a little angiogram, and they just shoot stuff in there. The beads, linked together by chemical bonds and magnetic forces, function like tiny articulate swimmers. Triggered by an external magnetic field, each, so probably an MRI maybe or some sort of machine like that, each individual's bead's rotation caused the string to twist like a corkscrew, propelling it through the blood. By manipulating the external magnetic field, surgeons can actually steer the beads directly into the blockages, where the corkscrew action then loosens arterial plaques. Processes are based on the bacterium that caused Lyme disease, which uses its spiral shape to move around and damage tissue. Min Jung Kim, who is the director of Drexler's Biological Accusation Sensing and Transportation Laboratory, says that his team's bio-inspired micro-swimmers are biodegradable and won't trigger an immune response inside of the body. Size and surface proteins can be adjusted to deal with various types of arterial occlusions. And once flow is restored into the artery, the microswimmer chains can be dispersed or used to deliver anticoagulant medication directly to the affected area to prevent future blockages. I mean, holy shit. This is unbelievable. And I mean, it isn't even nanobots, but it is Lyme bacteria-inspired nanobots using iron oxide nanoparticles and magnetic resonance of some kind to direct these little nanobodies to the affected arterial occlusion. I mean, honestly, I could use one of these. But again, what's so frightening to me personally is it seems that a lot of these things that we cover on this show end up being things in the future that I am faced with, like dangling carrots, that, you know, good thing that I researched it beforehand, but bad thing because it's almost like I'm sealing my own fate. Current treatments of chronic total occlusions are only about 60% successful, which is frightening because I talked about one of those old school treatments using the little balloons, the plasties, I don't know if that's what they call them, and the catheter with a vascular surgeon. So they're only about 60% successful. But this new method that we are developing could be as high as 80 to 90% successful and possibly shorten recovery time. Just a side note, if anyone has to ever go through some sort of angiogram or plasty of some kind, or where they have to get up and take a look to see where there's a blockage and they have to do that little catheter, there's two ways they can get into the artery. I don't know if you knew that. Maybe there's more, but I got poked in two different ways. One is right in the fold of your leg, in the groin, right on that bone in your hip, your inner hip there. And I got to tell you, that hurts like hell. You know, they give you some pain meds, and you might even be so out of it you don't notice it. But after the fact, trying to walk, and of course they make you get up right away and start walking. Trying to walk, you start to have a gimp for the first day or two. But then there's a second way, because they had trouble getting in my first way, and that is right in your wrist. And I got to tell you, I don't even think I felt that one. But anyway, that was just a side note. The Drexler team is the first U.S. representative to join this international initiative. Of course it is. Led by the government-funded Korea Evaluation Institute of Industrial Technologies in South Korea. Ding-a-la-la-ling. Another one of our offshore mad science countries. Australia is another one. In the popular Deus Ex video game series, nanotechnology can turn an average government agent into a bionic Superman. And yes, 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 we've talked about the Super Soldier program. That is something that is not science fiction. In fact, nanotech augmentation in the human body isn't just fun and games. Real-life applications will most likely become reality a lot sooner than you think, especially as they are packaging CRISPR-Cas9 into things such as adenovirus, which just comes on as a very mild cold that you can catch, or something like a plasmid that, oh, by the way, they are actually spraying all over our food already and you didn't even know it. In 2007, the world's first online inventory of nanotech products, Projects on Emerging Nanotechnologies, found that nearly 500 products, including food, clothing, and cosmetics, employed nanotech. And we spent probably 6 or 7 shows looking at nanotechnology in our environment and how it is being used and in wrappers and things that are touching your food that you didn't even know about. If you're too busy to make it to the gym, nanotech could be a way to get fit without having to spend hours toiling away on machines. And yes, that's how they're going to sell it, to make you healthy and give you a dashboard so you can manage your health more effectively. In fact, technology can take you a lot further than any free weight or cardio regimen. In 2006, University at of Texas at Dallas reported in the journal Science that they had created an alcohol and hydrogen-fueled artificial muscle that is 100 times stronger and capable of 100 times more work than natural muscles. functioning are both muscles and fuel cells, and that would probably be the ATP. And the technology is a range of applications from artificial limbs to autonomous robots. See, it's just what we need. If nanotech can make you stronger, could it also make you smarter? Well, step right up for your brain implant. Scientists aren't quite there yet, but nanotech applied to brain implants, told you, could treat a range of conditions from deafness to blindness to Parkinson's disease and more, according to biomedical engineers from the University of Michigan. Nanotechnology could also be used to tap into the mind, read and write information directly to the brain. And in an unusual twist, the research was undertaken by telecommunication engineer Nippon Telegraph and Telephone. I bet they're South Korean as well. Contact lenses, and we covered these as well. With visual displays may seem like the kind of technology you'd only see in a movie, but researchers at the University of Washington have started laying the groundwork to build contact lenses with internal circuitry and also with Wi-Fi, and they can project an image right onto your eyeball using wires made of metal only a few nanometers thick. The technology is placed in a contact lens rather than an implant, making the use of a bionic eye much easier. In this photo up above, the contact lens has been affixed to a poor little bunny rabbit, and the researchers believe that they would quickly be able to introduce a visual display, but it wouldn't be more than a few pixels in the near future. But I think when we wrote that story, there was like gigapixels or something that they were talking about. Tired of having to find an electrical outlet or a USB cable every time you need to charge your cell phone? Well, with nanotech, you can become a walking battery. Yay! That'll be how we pay for our existence. With nanotechnology, you can become a walking battery using nanowires to recover wasted heat energy from the body, which is then converted into electrical power, say researchers with the U.S. Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and University of California, Berkeley, where they have developed an entirely means of charging personal electronics. The same technology could be used to convert heat from other sources to electricity. As reported in the journal Nature, approximately 15 trillion watts of heat produced by engines of steam and gas-powered turbines and is lost to the environment. I actually read a while ago, and I meant to send it to a friend of mine who has a place in his attic that produces a lot of heat. There's a spray paint now, or maybe it's even a can of paint, that you can paint that then you connect somehow some little wires to bring the power back down and charge some batteries. But that paint actually absorbs the ambient heat. So like if you had a high cathedral ceiling, let's say, when the wintertime, all your heat's going to sit up there and not do you any good. You could recover that heat with this paint and use it to make electricity. So, you know what? This goes on and on and on. And I don't really want to get into nanotech and whatever. We're still looking at diseases. Plum Island, Nazi scientists. You almost forgot about all that. And ticks. So let's go another step further. Oh, wait. There was something else I wanted to talk about. Lyme disease. Oh, so we started talking about corkscrew nanobots. That's where this got us. And the story kind of went off on a tangent. These corkscrew nanobots and this bacteria that makes Lyme disease. Another thing that's interesting, not only is it a corkscrew bacteria, but one of the ways that Lyme disease becomes a chronic infection, and it persists for many, many years like some viruses do, hiding from the immune system. And this caught my attention, and Camille will appreciate this, is that it has a dormant state where it can hide in different parts of the body. And when it goes into a dormant state, it actually goes into what they're calling a spore formation. And remember, some of the other spore bacterias that we have looked at on past shows, one would be of the anthrax family, and that would be, and I don't remember the name now. Hold on. Wait, let me think. Let me think. Oh, I don't know, it's part of the anthrax family. Bacillus, the Bacillus bacteria. They have a flagella, and they go into dormant states where they could last a very long time, and they could withstand heat and all kinds of different things by going dormant. And that's one of the things that you don't ever want to get in your probiotic, is some sort of spore bacteria. Make sure you check the names. I think the bacillus are the ones that go into spores. So, all right, where do we go from here? So that's why Lyme disease is so stealth. That's why it is so difficult to treat. That's why it's become such an epidemic. Here's a story from a woman who is a sufferer. And I got to tell you, having my own chronic issues, and mine happened to be viruses that I've had since I was probably 15 or 16 years old. It fired back up again. They're called reactivated. That's what happens. You have these dormant infections that you don't know about because mine happened to get into my DNA. These are these DNA viruses. We're not going to talk about DNA viruses today. But another one is these bacteria that can evade the immune system. And a lot of these infections come along with what are called co-infections, where one or two things, multiple things are going on that can mimic other diseases. And conventional medicine has, I gotta say it, to be quite honest, no fucking clue. Excuse my language there, but it's absolutely true. I've gone through three different periods of my life where I've had reactivations or initial infections that the only way that I was able to find any relief and any cure is to do it myself. And that takes a lot of time and dedication, a lot of research on my part, a lot of trial and error and experimentation on myself. And I've talked about that before. I don't encourage it unless, of course, you know, you're smart and you do your research. But I finally found a real doctor. And unfortunately, he is not affiliated in any way with any type of insurance company, which is probably smart for him because he doesn't have to answer to some big board who tells him whether or not his treatments are approved or not. But I found a doctor, and he happens to be Egyptian, which I thought was interesting because some of my best doctors have come from either India or Egypt or China even, who are outside of the full encompassing realm of the big pharma complex here in the United States, and they tend to look at things a little bit differently. But after my first visit with this guy, he ordered this massive battery of tests, which thank God were covered by insurance, 17 different blood tests that I had never been tested for before, but all these different titers and what are they called, where they're looking for antibodies. Like if you're producing all these different antibodies that could show a correlation to some other entity that is causing these antibodies. But I have to say, he's very smart. And he came upon three different things that nobody has ever looked for. And bing, my numbers are off the charts. So just going to tell you, trying to research my own personal health issues has led me down all these paths of the stuff that we're looking at now. But how frighteningly we have these untethered, mad science gone mad laboratories on the homeland. Not only that, but all over the world. And all of these scientists are just fighting each other. It's like cutthroat competition to get funding and come up with the newest, best way to not only, you know, under the guise of curing you, but also killing millions of people. I mean, if they can find what is causing disease, they can also figure out how to make disease, which was the premise behind places like Fort Detrick, Maryland, and Plum Island. So, right, I came across a blog by somebody who sounds like me, who actually had their life changed by getting a debilitating, unidentified, undiagnosed illness that they had to fight and dig to figure out what was going on. This is, I guess her name is Amy Tan, but it's amytan.net. Titled Lyme Disease, How a Tiny Speck, and that would be a speck of tick, changed my life forever. I used to brag that I never got sick, and I rarely came down with colds or flus. I had health insurance for catastrophic illnesses, but I only used it once for a surgical repair of a broken leg, the result of a skiing accident. And in 1999, all that changed. And that's actually when my second bout hit me, when this was hers. I learned what it was like to have a disease with no diagnosis, to be baffled by what insurance covered and what it doesn't, and to have a mind that can't think fast enough to know whether a red traffic light means to press the gas or hit the brakes. I have, and this is the author, late-stage neuroborreliosis, otherwise known as Lyme disease. The neurological part reflects the fact that the bacteria called a spirochete, and that's what I was trying to think of, this little corkscrew, called the Borrelia burgdorferi, has gone into my brain. Remember, these things can travel all over the body. In many cases, my case is in many ways typical. Like many, and I found there's thousands and thousands of stories of these freaky diseases that there is no diagnosis except by smart doctors that aren't brainwashed by Western medicine. Like many, I had little awareness of Lyme disease. I did not think about my Lyme because I live in California. At least that's where I found my taxes. But for a good long while, it did not seem significant to me or to others that I also have a home in New York State. And I spent weekends in upstate New York. But I'm not saying I have Lyme, though Munchkin got bit by a tick when she was really little and got that bullseye rash, which that's why this is kind of scaring me as well. Then again, but we did get treatment back at that time, but who knows, because these things lay dormant for 30 years and then come back. Then again, one does not need to live in the East Coast to get Lyme, because you can go hiking in the woodlands of Mendocino, Santa Cruz, and the Sierra foothills, just to name a few hiking spots where Lyme ticks are and I am fond of. But my particular interloper found me at an outdoor wedding in July of 1999. I was in Dutchess County, New York, a place that is lushly bucolic, complete with babbling brooks and trees, logs to sit on, and cool grass for walking barefoot, which is a big lot of New York. It's just like that. Dutchess County, I would learn later, also had the most number of cases of Lyme disease in the country that year. And I think Dutchess County is kind of over on the East Coast, more near New York than we are here in Western New York. And the particular swath that I was in had 10 times the number of cases of Lyme disease than the rest of the country. The day after the wedding, I saw a bright red rash on my shin. And I briefly thought about Lyme disease, but the rash lacked that bullseye and that most infectious disease doctors say is a characteristic of Lyme. So no worries. My rash had a tiny black speck in the center. What I assumed was a pinprick-sized blood blister, the result of possibly, perhaps, a spider bite. I avoided scratching it, and thus I watched the dot grow more rounded. And what I was watching, of course, was a nymph tick, and that is the very smallest, like the tiniest size of a pin, feeding on my leg and regurgitating its bacteria into me. That black dot fell out, but the rash grew larger and brighter red, and after a month, the light red splotches bloomed on my arms. And the day after I was infected, I had another symptom, and a very unusual one for me, and unusual for anyone in the summer. I had aches, pains, and fever of the flu, but I had not had the flu in about 15 years, and I was disappointed my record had come to an end. But within a day, I managed to beat it back, and I never developed respiratory symptoms, not even a stuffy nose or a hacking cough. So I thought to myself, ha, what a great immune system I have. Well, guess what? More symptoms crept up, which I passed off as related to stress and airline travel. And that would be a stiff neck, insomnia, constant headache, and a backache, followed by a frozen shoulder. And I was often tired and jittery. But that, I reasoned, was a consequence of actual life and too much coffee. Who was I to complain? I had a wonderful life, a great husband, a lovely home, and a successful career. But then my feet grew tingly and I became numb. And at my annual checkup, I mentioned this to my doctor, and she said I had neuropathy, which is not caused by stress. I related that I had developed a strange rash a few months earlier. Could it be relevant? No, my doctor said. But like many chronic Lyme disease patients, I was launched into a medical maze, searching for answers as things worsened. And I told my husband that something in my body had broken. I was falling apart, and I know how that feels. I went from specialist to specialist, and each one found some possible cause within his or her specialty. and the weirdest symptom, and of course, and then gave you more drugs for whatever they found. And the weirdest symptom was plunging blood sugar going down to 20s or 30s before bouncing back up to normal. That so alarmed my doctors that they hospitalized me, and an MRI revealed 14 lesions on my frontal and parietal lobes, and that would be in the brain. But my doctors felt that that was normal for a person of my age. I was 49 at the time. Yeah, right about when your body starts falling apart. Then I had a CAT scan, and that showed an incidental anoma on my adrenal gland, a small 2-centimeter tumor. And that could be the reason for the blood sugar plunges, the racing heart, the specialist said, or it could be benign or not. And an option was presented. I could have a CAT scan every 6 months at my expense since my insurance did not cover preventative care. Or I could have my adrenal gland removed on the premise that this was the cause of my symptoms, in which case insurance would cover everything. And my tests so far are the surgery and the follow-up meds. The surgery was supposed to take a half an hour, but then there were complications, and the artery to my spleen was accidentally cut off, and in the end, the surgery took 5 whole hours. Then they put me on cortisone, which is a steroid, and you probably shouldn't be taking that anyway, and the symptoms abated, but only briefly before they worsened. It became more bizarre. Now I had hallucinations. Now, guys, this is what happens. Like, it starts from something little, and these undiagnosed diseases where they're sending you through this maze of things, and you can just get sicker and sicker, because what happens is that they decimate your immune system, and there are these latent things that we've been exposed to that are ubiquitous in our environment, where 70 to 90% of the general population of the globe are infected with them, things such as Epstein-Barr virus, and they just decimate in mycoplasmas, which we're going to look at as well again coming up here shortly if I can make it. They are things that destroy cells one by one. And as that happens, these other diseases that can't be diagnosed, such as Lyme in this woman's case, start to decimate your bodily systems. So now I had hallucinations, which I later learned from a neurologist were simple partial seizures. I saw people walking into the room, two girls jumping rope, and a number spinning on a lit up odometer, as well as a fat poodle hanging from the ceiling. Oh my God. They disappeared after a minute or so. And after the first hallucination, I did not take the others for anything other than a weird brain quirk. Well, that would be very frightening. Most were fairly entertaining. The ones with sudden putrid rat smells were not. And then there were other more serious seizures, complex partials with an absence of consciousness. My husband said that I acted at times as if I were in a trance, eyes wide open, and in fact, many times my memory of things that just happened before and just after the seizure had been erased. By day, my memory was held together by friable threads. My concentration was easy to disperse as blown dust. And when I tried to read, I also often found by the second page, I had no idea what the book was about. But then I wrote by hand. I reversed letters. And when I spoke, I substituted words with like-sounding beginnings. But I did not possess any of the skills necessary to write fiction. I was barely able to traverse the distance from sentence to sentence, let alone keep my mind in a narrative that had to span 400 pages and keep taut multiple intricacies of a plot, characters, and thematic imagery in my mind. Thus, my novel in progress lay abandoned between feeble attempts to resuscitate it. And at times when asked what I was writing, to my horror, I could not remember. And I would struggle over the next hour trying to recall the faintest details. Now think about that. I mean, if some of these diseases could start wiping out our brains, and of course we have this whole epidemic of neurological diseases, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, post-traumatic stress disorder, and dopamine disorders as well, all different buttons pushed in the brain. Think about the things that they could do if something were accidentally released. And remember, this is Lyme disease. This is without it being wiped out of our system. It's considered chronic Lyme. There are a lot of these cases where they weren't properly treated or knocked out because that bacteria had gone into a dormant state, was able to hide. At one point I was reading, it hides in the joints. I no longer dared to get behind the wheel of a car, and when I did venture out on foot, I would sometimes find myself lost in what I knew was a familiar place, which was my neighborhood for 30 years. Why didn't that building around the corner look familiar? Why did everything seem as if it were the first time I had been there? I had easily become lost in stores, hospitals, hotels, and I would panic, certain that I was losing my mind and developing dementia related to early Alzheimer's. My anxiety was a hundredfold of what was warranted, even in a post-9/11 era, and eventually I could no longer leave my house alone. And in any case, it hurt to walk too far. My muscles were stiff, my knees and hips ached, and I was almost too tired to care anymore. I hate to tell you guys, but that's about where I feel right now, is just so tired and exhausted and needing to take the strength that I have in research, which is a full-time job, I got to tell you, different vitamins, minerals, supplements, and things that they have found to boost the immune system to be able to put some of these viruses back into a dormant state. And I have to get stress out of my life because that's another trigger to these things. Let me add here that my doctors were affiliated with major urban hospitals. Of course they were. And they were top in their department, well-known and respected, and I liked them. But not once did they raise the idea that I was a hypochondriac, which is, to be honest, like when some of these unknown illnesses first started, which in the beginning was known as chronic fatigue syndrome, if you guys remember that. That was back in the late 80s, early 90s that it became a key phrase, and it became most popular after the Gulf War and known as the Gulf War Syndrome. But it went way beyond that. Chronic fatigue syndrome was spread across the United States, and we're going to take a look at some of what they found. I don't know if I'm going to make it. I got five more tabs till I get there, so maybe not this show. But we will get back to chronic fatigue syndrome and mycoplasmas. Not once did they raise the idea that I was a hypochondriac, and I'm going to say that just because your doctors can't find it, as we have already seen in a lot of the research that we do on this show, just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. And there's been mad science gone mad going on for a very, very, very long time without the best of containment strategies, where things have gotten out. And we listened to Carl tell his first person point of view story of what he has seen and what he has learned in his many years of research about some of the horrors of Plum Island, and that it probably did get out, and I would expect that it did. But they also did not raise the possibility of Lyme disease. One doctor, however, gave me a battery of tests, including one called the ELISA, and that's the ELISA. I looked it up and saw that it was a screening test for Lyme. There I saw all of my symptoms. And when the doctor told me that the test was negative, and that's something that they have found a lot of, that Lyme tests do show up negative, I asked him about the accuracy of the test. And the doctor said that it was impossible for me to get Lyme in California. I said that I also lived in New York. He said that Lyme was so rare that it was impossible that I had it. And actually, it's not. In any case, he had not tested me for Lyme. He said that it was ELISA, and that was for another spirochetal infection, and that would be syphilis. Syphilis is of the family as well. Wait, he thought I was more likely to have syphilis than Lyme? So I turned to the internet, which is where doctors believe hypochondriacs catch terminal diseases. And there I read more about Lyme and about the inadequacies of the ELISA, especially in late-stage cases, one that is more beyond a month since the infection. I also had the same rash that I had 4 years before and read about bizarre symptoms like mine. Further sleuthing gave me the name of a Lyme-literate physician in San Francisco. And that's the one thing. You know, they say that everything on the internet is a conspiracy theory, but I'm going to tell you, especially in cases like this, finding forums where people have similar symptoms and some of the things that they have done to bring their symptoms back into check is really the most prominent way to treat some of this stuff. And doctors who specialize in this stuff are very far and few between. My Lyme doctor, and this would be this new one, considered the history of my rash, the summertime flu, the migration of aches and neuropathy, the insomnia and fatigue, and he thought the lesions on my brain were significant in light of my neurological symptoms. He saw in previous tests that I had some interesting changes in my immune system. Ding, ding. So he ordered a complete battery of tests from a lab specializing in tick-borne illnesses to check not only for Lyme disease, but also its co-infections. Ding, ding. All of which can be carried by the very same tick that gave you Lyme. 2 weeks later, I learned that I was positive for Lyme on the Western blot, as well as the PCR, which is the polymerase chain reaction, which can help detect actual DNA debris of the tick. My doctor told me that these tests not only confirmed what he'd already knew. So let me hasten to add that not all chronic Lyme patients test positive, at least not at levels set by doctors who follow CDC surveillance criteria as a diagnostic. Of course they don't, because then there'd be thousands of more cases that they would have to explain. There is much more to be done before the test can be considered reliable in every lab in the country. And unfortunately, most doctors still go by the old and unreliable standard. And that would be that Lyme is rare and exists only on the East Coast, and that a bullseye rash and fever must be present, and that you are tested first with an ELISA, which is considered a false positive if you had no bullseye rash. If you did have the bullseye, then you must get a Western blot, and that would get you about 2 weeks of antibiotics, but further insurance coverage of treatment and medication is denied. And that is the standard recipe that has destroyed many lives. Like many late-stage neurological Lyme patients, it took a while for the symptoms to begin to lift. And a day after starting the antibiotic treatment, I became feverish and ill with the classic reaction, which serves as a second confirmation of a spirochetal bacterial infection. A month later, the joint and muscle pain eased up somewhat. 2 months, some of the brain fog finally lifted, and I finally wrote for long days, fearful that the curtain would come down again. After 6 months, I had less muscle stiffness and no joint pain remaining. And after 2 years, I was actually back to feeling well. This is insane, guys. So this goes on and on and on. Her antibiotics were not covered by insurance, and it cost her $500 a month. And whenever she went off the antibiotics, the problems came marching back one by one. This is horrifying. So now let's talk about ticks. So there's all these ticks all over the United States, all types of different types of ticks. And you got to make sure you take a look at that CDC map document. There's 5 or 6 different maps there. Where's one that we covered before? But I would like to cover this again in light of what we are talking about today. So back last year, or is this this year? No, it doesn't have a day, a year on it, but it's April 21st. I think this was this year. Maybe it was last year. No, it was this year because I told my mother about it and she was very interested because she's into bugs. This is titled "A Swarming Exotic Tick Species is Now Living Year-Round in New Jersey." And this would be the ticks that they discovered that mysteriously got here and that clone themselves. Oh, yeah, 2018. An exotic species of tick, and this would be an Asian tick, that mysteriously appeared in New Jersey last year is now here to stay. And this would probably be, we did cover this last year, and then the winter set in. But now that spring is here, they are starting to find them all over. The New Jersey Department of Agriculture announced on Friday that the East Asian tick, so this would be for any of my friends in the tri-state area, also known as the longhorn tick or the bush tick, which was discovered in Hunterdon County Farm last year, has survived the winter. Ongoing surveillance continued during the winter, and on April 17, 2018, the National Veterinary Services Laboratory confirmed the longhorn tick has successfully overwintered in New Jersey and has become possibly established in the state. Last summer, a farmer walked into the Hunterdon County Health Office covered in 1,000 ticks after she was shearing a 12-year-old Icelandic sheep named Hannah, who had never left the country, I read in another story. Experts were called in to identify the tick, which was not previously known to exist in the United States. Da-la-la-la-la-ling. The Department of Agriculture says that it still does not know how the tick made its way to New Jersey. The sheep has never traveled internationally and has rarely ever left the Hunterdon County, according to Andre Agassi, a tick specialist at the Monmouth County Tick-Borne Disease Laboratory. When the incident was first reported, steps were taken to eradicate the insect from the farm by using a chemical wash on the sheep and removing all the tall grass where they are known to dwell. The exact location on the farm and the identity of the sheep farmers being withheld by the New Jersey Department of Agriculture. And although ticks are known to carry disease such as spotted fever, rickettsiosis, in other parts of the world, tests performed on the tick in the farm animals were actually negative for diseases, at least right now. And I had read in a story this morning on my other computer that the Asian tick actually is another one of those ticks that can harbor Lyme disease, and they catch it from rodents. So now that these are well established in New Jersey, it won't be too long before these, cloning ticks that are overtaking and swarming New Jersey will be carrying disease. Local, state, federal animal health and wildlife officials, as well as Rutgers University Center for Vector Biology, are now all working together to eliminate the ticks and stop them from spreading. Wildlife and livestock experts in the area will continue to monitor throughout the years. The ticks are known to swarm and infest deer and animals other than sheep, so the department is warning that it has a potential to infect other North American wildlife species. And these ticks reproduce asexually, ding-a-ling, by cloning themselves. And notice, like, how far along into the article it took them to tell you that. And just one of them is capable of laying thousands and thousands of eggs. State and federal Department of Agriculture employees will be working with the public to determine if the tick spread to and if the tick has spread, and to educate the public about protecting their livestock and pets from the pests. The nymph of these ticks is very, very small and resembles a very tiny spider, and it's easy to miss, according to the Department of Agriculture. And they are dark brown, about the size of a pea when fully grown, and can be found in tall grasses. So screw going into the woods this summer if you live in New York or New Jersey. Authorities are asking people to contact the state veterinarian if they see any unusual ticks on their livestock. Unusual ticks detected in wildlife should be reported to the New Jersey Division of Fish and Wildlife. And any questions about tick-borne illnesses in humans should be directed to any local health department within the state. So now, and we read about this one last year, experts warn of an increase in tick-borne Paswan virus as well. And we had also read back at the time that there is no cure and doctors just want you to be comfortable. So hopefully you don't die from it. And that's what they said. Summer is nearly here, and this is May 3rd, 2017, so a year ago. And it's bringing fears of a rare tick-borne disease called Paswan. This potentially life-threatening virus is carried and transmitted on three types of ticks, including the deer tick that transmits Lyme disease. Over the past decade, 75 cases have been reported in the northeastern United States and the Great Lakes region, ding, exactly where I am, according to the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Though no one can say how many infections will occur this year, warmer winters have led, of course, it's climate change, have led to an increase of tick populations, and experts predict rising tick-borne infections of many types. Yeah, how convenient that the bullseye of this epidemic happens to be in the same area as Plum Island. Just saying, guys. Everyone is at risk for Paswan, newborns, 20-somethings, middle-aged, and elderly, as well as the immunocompromised. And that'd be all those people that have these strange illnesses that no doctor can diagnose or treat. Anyone bitten by an infected tick can get it. And about 15% of the patients who are infected have symptoms, and they are not going to survive, says Lyons, who is an assistant professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. Yes. Of the survivors, at least 50% will have long-term neurological damage that is not going to resolve. And that was how many? 50% with long-term neurological damage, guys. This is really nuts. And although most infected people will never, ever show symptoms, and that's what a lot of these diseases are like, those who do become sick usually do so a few days to about a week after the tick bite, and the most common symptoms will be fever and headache. You basically feel nonspecific flu-like stuff, says Lyons, including muscle aches and pains. Maybe you have a little rash on your skin, but almost certainly you will have a fever and a little bit of a headache. The unlucky few who develop a more serious illness will do so quickly. Over the next couple of days, you start to develop difficulties with maintaining your consciousness and your cognition, and you may develop seizures. You may develop an inability to breathe on your own. What? And there is no vaccine to prevent this infection. There are also no treatments for Passawan. There are some experimental therapies, and we try them when someone comes in and they get it early enough, and they get the therapy started early enough, but we have no idea of if it works. Standard treatments include intravenous fluids, though antiviral medications, systemic corticosteroids, and other drugs have been tried in some patients. Scientists also believe that Passawan is on the rise based on studies that have identified an increasing number of infections in deer. So it does seem that there are more and more deer that they are finding that have been infected with this virus. And so we should expect it to increase in the human disease incidence over the next few years. Similarly, Lyme is showing an increased numbers. According to a recent tick summary, 19% of deer ticks received tested by the Connecticut Agricultural Experimental Station was found to be infected with Lyme, and 29% of the deer ticks also tested positive for the virus in 2016. And a bad tick season is coming, so look out. It's pretty nuts. So where are we going to go from here? Let's hit this story. So Passawan is another tick-borne virus you need to be concerned about. So here is something out of Public Health Alert, out of imed.org. In 2009, titled Mycoplasma, an Overlooked Disease in Chronic Lyme. Those of us with chronic Lyme disease are quite familiar with the names of the better known Lyme co-infections, and that would be Babesia, Bartonella, and Escherichia, and they have become everyday words. As much as we would like to rid ourselves of these illness-producing pathogens, they have become a part of our daily struggle to regain a sense of health and wellness. Unfortunately, these are not the only co-infections seen with chronic Lyme. And for some reason, mycoplasma co-infections are not only lesser known by patients, but seemingly often overlooked by doctors as well. It is important for us as patients to educate ourselves on the topic of mycoplasma and to ask our practitioners how we are being evaluated and treated for these infections. In 1987, and this is what I was telling you about in Project Daylily, that one book I was reading, Dr. Garth Nicholson, a PhD, was a professor at the University of Texas at Houston when his wife, who was also an instructor at Baylor University College of Medicine in Texas, became seriously ill and nearly died. She was diagnosed with a mycoplasma infection, treated, and later recovered. And then a few years later, their daughter, and it was his stepdaughter, who served in the Gulf War, and this is where I was talking about the Gulf War syndrome, returned from active duty quite ill, and so did her entire platoon. They started looking for an illness, and not only was she sick, but the symptoms that she exhibited were very similar to that of Dr. Nicholson's wife that she had earlier. At that point, Dr. Nicholson had the idea that his daughter's illness could be the result of an infection and started to investigate his theory further. And as his work progressed, he looked at Brucella, Borrelia, Escherichia, and other chronic intracellular infections that have potential to cause illness persistent with overlapping symptoms and signs. in Gulf War veterans that were being evaluated, approximately 45% of those that were ill had mycoplasma infections. And it was found that the infection was of a particular type of mycoplasma, and that was an a particular species called Mycoplasma fermentans. Very little was known about this species at the time, except that the Air Force Institute of Pathology in the Army had been doing research on this organism. Once this likely causative agent in Gulf War illness had been identified, about one half of the Gulf War cases, Dr. Nicholson recommended that the mycoplasma-infected Gulf War veterans be treated with doxycycline. He then found himself the target of vicious attacks and making this connection between the illness and this mycoplasma fermentans. Dr. Nicholson shared that even talking about this organism was highly discouraged, and that was because a lot of the financing from the military was going on at Baylor College, and they were infecting prisoners as a test bed in some of the prisons in Texas. Just years earlier in Texas, prisons emerged in which many of the prison inmates and guards had come down with a neurodegenerative condition at rates that were far from ordinary. In Huntsville, where three large state prisons were found, there were about 70 cases of ALS, and that would be this is one of the ALS brain diseases, numerous cases of multiple sclerosis, and highly unexpected numbers of rheumatoid arthritis cases. At that time, the term mystery disease was used to identify this unusual illness that many seem to have acquired. Dr. Nicholson started testing prison guards and their family members and found a very high number of these people testing positive for mycoplasma fermentans. And furthermore, this appeared to be a weaponized version of the organism called Mycoplasma fermentans incognitus, because it can hide a specific strain of mycoplasma that have been altered or genetically modified to cause more severe symptoms, to be more virulent, and to be more survivable than naturally occurring mycoplasma fermentans. And we're going to find out on the show on Wednesday. We're going to read a segment out of Jim Marr's book called Trillion Dollar Conspiracy that looks at the mycoplasmas being developed that he's talking about here by Nazi scientists.